CFRC 101.9 FM is hosting its first annual radio-a-thon in support of our annual funding drive on Wednesday, November 27th. Starting at 8 a.m., we'll have 24 hours of live programming with your favorite Wednesday regulars and specialty programming from other hosts. Tune in to hear the fun, the chaos, and everything in between while we bunker down with the CFRC ghost.
Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan, this is Democracy Now!
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! News. Thank you so much for making the COP presidency available to the press. Many journalists and climate activists have been arrested here in Azerbaijan in the lead-up to the COP. My question is, will they, among many other arrests in this lead-up to the COP, be freed?
We'll bring you the response of Azerbaijan's deputy foreign minister, who is also COP29 lead negotiator. And we'll speak with the acting editor of the independent media outlet Absas here in Azerbaijan. She's in exile. Six of her journalists were arrested in the lead-up to the summit. But first, we go to Susana Mohammed, Colombia's environment minister. She chairs Colombia's delegation here at COP29. We'll ask her about Colombia's decision to become the first major oil-producing nation to join the Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty Coalition. And we'll ask her about Colombia's coal embargo on Israel over Gaza. Mohammed is a Colombian of Palestinian descent. We'll also get her response to Trump's re-election.
It's a big call. It's a big call of progressives everywhere. Neoliberal economics is actually creating a bigger monster, and that we have to create an alternative model that really, really includes and improves the quality of life of the most vulnerable.
And we'll look at President Trump's pick for Secretary of Education. That's President-elect Trump. Yes, the Secretary of Education that he has chosen, the billionaire former head of World Wrestling Entertainment, Linda McMahon. Trump has also picked Dr. Mehmet Oz, the television doctor, to run the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Oz is a backer of privatizing Medicare. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. The United States has shut down its embassy in Ukraine's capital and ordered U.S. citizens in Kyiv to immediately seek shelter, citing a potential air attack by Russia. The warning came as Ukraine, for the first time, used U.S.-supplied long-range ATACMS missiles to strike targets deep inside Russia. This follows President Vladimir Putin's warning that Russia had lowered its threshold for the use of nuclear weapons in response to escalating U.S. and European support for Ukrainian counterattacks on Russian soil. At the United Nations, Ukraine's UN ambassador Tuesday read a statement co-signed by 42 European Union members, marking the 1,000th day of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
We have to make the Russians sit down at the table of negotiations, and the only way to do it is by strength.
In Moscow, a Kremlin spokesperson ruled out a freeze of the war in Ukraine along existing front lines. Meanwhile, Russia's military says it seized another settlement in Ukraine's eastern Donetsk region. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports President Biden has quietly approved the provision of new anti-personnel landmines to Ukraine. Biden had already authorized the transfer of cluster munitions and a different type of anti-personnel mine to Ukraine. The latest transfers clearly violate the mine ban treaty known as the Ottawa Convention. Neither Russia nor the United States is among the 164 parties who've agreed to the treaty. On Tuesday, the International Campaign to Ban Landmines released its annual report, which finds there were more than 5,700 deaths and injuries from landmines worldwide last year, about 1,000 more than in 2022. In a statement, the group's director wrote, quote, any use of anti-personnel mines by any actor under any circumstances is unacceptable and must be condemned. All countries that have not yet done so should join the mine ban treaty to turn back this tide and end the suffering caused by these vile weapons, unquote. In Gaza, the Palestinian Health Ministry reports Israeli attacks on Tuesday killed at least 50 Palestinians and wounded 110 others. Overnight, the director of the besieged Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza warned 85 injured Palestinians are at imminent risk of death after an Israeli attack damaged the hospital's upper floors. Dr. Hussam Abu Safia said the hospital had received a large influx of children with signs of malnutrition and is facing an extreme catastrophe, he said. In the southern Gaza Strip, Palestinian security forces have shot and killed 20 people accused of an organized effort to loot convoys delivering desperately needed aid into Gaza. Monday's killings came 2 days after armed gangs violently looted nearly 100 trucks carrying food provided by the United Nations. A spokesperson for the UN's Refugee Agency for Palestinians said Israeli authorities had instructed the convoy to use an unfamiliar route on short notice ahead of the ambush. Dropsite News reports the Israeli military has systematically targeted Palestinian security forces charged with protecting aid shipments while allowing armed gunmen to attack aid convoys in areas under Israeli control. On Tuesday, desperate Palestinians queued up at a soup kitchen in Khan Yunis hoping for a meal after a shortage of flour forced a main bakery in central Gaza to halt operations.
We're all hungry. There's no flour. It's been a month that we don't have flour, frying oil, or sugar. We want some tea to drink. We want to make bread. We are hungry and need food and beverage. It is shameful what they are doing to the people.
In more news from Gaza, Al Jazeera Arabic journalist Hossam Shabat was injured on Tuesday in an Israeli attack on a home in Gaza City. Shabat had been covering the aftermath of an Israeli bombing when a second strike hit. He wrote on social media the attack was deliberate, adding, quote, the moment I stepped inside, the house was bombed again and dismembered body parts of the wounded flew around me, he said. A first responder and civilians were killed in the strike. On Capitol Hill, more than four dozen peace activists were arrested Tuesday as they held a protest inside the Hart Senate office building demanding an end to U.S. arms transfers to Israel. Protesters led by Jewish Voice for Peace wore red T-shirts demanding education, housing, health care and jobs, quote, not genocide, unquote. Separately in Chicago, more than a dozen Jewish peace activists were arrested as they nonviolently blocked escalators and elevators to shut down business operations at Caterpillar's business and analytics hub. Caterpillar supplies Israel's military with armored bulldozers used to demolish homes and businesses in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. The protest came ahead of an expected vote in the Senate today on resolutions authored by Vermont's independent Senator Bernie Sanders that would block the sale of U.S. tank rounds, bomb kits, and other lethal weapons to Israel.
The truth of the matter is that from a legal perspective, these resolutions are not complicated. They're cut and dry. The United States government is currently in violation of the law, and every member of the U.S. Senate who believes in the rule of law should vote for these resolutions.
On Monday, one of the largest U.S. labor unions, the 2 million-strong SEIU, Service Employees International Union, called on senators to approve Sanders' resolution. Union President April Verrett said, quote, SEIU members have made clear they want an end to taxpayer dollars being used to fund military aid that enables attacks against innocent civilians in Gaza, unquote. President-elect Trump has picked TV personality Dr. Mehmet Oz to run the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Oz ran unsuccessfully for Senate in Pennsylvania in 2022. He's a backer of privatizing Medicare. Georgetown professor Lawrence Gostin criticized the selection of Oz, saying, quote, he peddles conspiracy theories on vaccines and fake cures. He profits from fringe medical ideas. By nominating RFK Jr. and Mehmet Oz, Trump is giving his middle finger to science, he said. Trump has also nominated Linda McMahon to head the Department of Education, which Trump has pledged to shut down. McMahon is the former CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment. She headed the Small Business Administration during the first Trump term. She gave at least $15 million to a pro-Trump PAC during his election. She and her husband, Vince McMahon, were recently sued for failing to stop a WWE ringside announcer from sexually assaulting young boys. Linda McMahon is the co-chair of Trump's transition team with another billionaire, Howard Lutnick, the chief executive of the Wall Street firm Cantor Fitzgerald. On Tuesday, Trump picked Lutnick to serve as Commerce Secretary. In other transition news, ABC News is reporting the House Ethics Committee obtained records that appear to show Trump's pick for Attorney General Matt Gaetz sent over $10,000 to two women who claim he paid them for sex. Gaetz resigned his seat in Congress last week, putting an end to the House Ethics Committee probe. While House leaders are resisting calls to release the committee's findings, a hacker has reportedly gained access to the sealed testimony in the probe. The Texas General Land Office has offered the incoming Trump administration a 1,400-acre ranch near the U.S.-Mexico border as a construction site for immigration jails after Trump promised to call up the military to carry out mass deportations. The offer came as Los Angeles City Council approved a sanctuary city ordinance forbidding city employees and resources from being involved in federal immigration enforcement. The measure passed unanimously Tuesday. The same day, the Los Angeles Unified School District reaffirmed its status as a sanctuary district for immigrants. This is Shuming Cheer of the California Immigrant Policy Center.
We're extremely concerned, given that this is a city where about a third of the population is immigrants. We are all extremely concerned, worried, panicked, afraid that the National Guard or other people are going to be forced to execute Trump's mass deportation plans. But, you know, we're also organized. We've been through this before. We know how to respond. We have a lot of tools at our disposal, including the legal system, including the strength in our communities. So we also know that we can fight back with power.
Republican Congress member Nancy Mace has introduced a resolution to ban transgender women from using women's bathrooms in the U.S. Capitol following the historic election of Sarah McBride, who recently became the first openly transgender candidate elected to Congress. McBride will represent Delaware in the House beginning in January. She called the resolution, McBride, that is, a blatant attempt from far right-wing extremists to distract from the fact that they have no real solutions to what Americans are facing, McBride said. And in Texas, a majority of the State Board of Education has voiced support for a new Bible-based curriculum for students in kindergarten through fifth grade. If approved, Texas public schools would be given financial incentives to use the optional curriculum. The president of the Texas American Federation of Teachers, Zeph Capo, criticized the new curriculum.
We've had the same government. Many of the same players behind it in the state of Texas actually making accusations against our educators that we're indoctrinating students when, in fact, as this curriculum comes to development and is implemented in school districts, particularly because they are focusing on kids so young and so impressionable, that we will, in fact, have a state government that's indoctrinating students.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. We begin today's show with Colombia's Minister of Environment, Susana Mohamed, who's held the position since 2022 when the government of the President Gustavo Petro took office. Mohamed is Colombia's lead climate negotiator here at COP29. I ask for her response to Donald Trump's reelection. If you could talk about the significance of Donald Trump being reelected president in the United States. He says he will once again pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement.
Yes, it is absolutely a disaster for global climate because, of course, you know, the U.S. is one of the big emitters in the world and has a big responsibility. So far, if the U.S. pulls out, I think there's two consequences. One, it will create a vacuum for other countries to take their place, its place. And I see, for example, China very committed to multilateralism and ready to hopefully step in. But secondly, something that is
it would be
important.
A big deal because China is now the largest polluter. I mean, U.S. is historically.
Yes, exactly. Historically. But in any case, are the countries that have more economic capacity and commitment for starting the decarbonization first and bringing emissions down globally. I mean, if China and the U.S. don't do anything on this, we can all do a lot, but the problem will not be solved. Now, secondly, I think we have to reflect further, because this trend of the far right coming to power is not only in the U.S. We have seen that happening in Europe. We have seen that in Latin America. Actually, the Argentinian government pulled out also the delegation. And what is the deeper reflection? That these transitions have to take into account the most vulnerable people in the planet. The people have to feel that this ecological and economic transition will improve their quality of life. So far, we are not doing that because we are still in this liberal economy, playing the same rules of the game, neoliberalism. And what's happening is that masses of population are just left behind. And that's the perfect condition for right-wing populists to come and put environment against the people, which is actually an environmental and a social disaster. And to sell that actually fossil fuels and the old way of development is the answer, which actually is a total trap because what it has created is a lot of inequality, as we know. So the call Colombia is also making here is that the just transition is not a game, that the finance needs to come also to developing countries, and then everywhere we have to put the most vulnerable people and the people that are on the front line of climate change for inclusion. Otherwise, we actually create the risk of political backlash on climate, as we are actually seeing.
Were you shocked when Trump won?
It is a big call. It's a big call of progressives everywhere that neoliberal economics is actually creating a bigger monster, and that we have to create an alternative model that really, really includes and improves the quality of life of the most vulnerable.
That was Colombia's Minister of Environment, Chair of the UN Climate Delegation for Colombia here in Baku, Azerbaijan for COP29. I also had a chance to sit down with Susana Mohamed for an in-depth interview to look at how Colombia President Gustavo Petro's administration has made climate issues central to its agenda. Colombia's Vice President, Francia Marquez, is a longtime Afro-Colombian environmentalist who's long fought for the protection of land and natural resources, while President Petro has halted the approval of new oil drilling projects and has vowed to phase out fossil fuels in Colombia, the oil-rich nation. The Petro administration has also led efforts to fight deforestation in the Amazon rainforest. Last year, Colombia became the first major fossil fuel-producing nation to join the Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty Coalition, setting a path toward an ambitious energy transition. Colombia has also just hosted the UN Biodiversity Summit, known as COP16, in the city of Cali. The summit concluded earlier this month without a much sought-after agreement on funding by wealthy countries, but some good news emerged from the summit as well, concluding a measure establishing a permanent indigenous consulting body at the UN to weigh in on conservation issues. This all comes as Colombia earlier this year banned all coal exports to Israel over its devastating war on Gaza. Colombia is the world's sixth largest coal exporter. Minister Mohamed was born in the Colombian capital of Bogota as of Palestinian descent. I began by asking her thoughts on the status of this year's climate negotiations here in Baku so far.
We are in a very difficult discussion, a very difficult negotiation. We are seeing two trends. Right now, the whole negotiation is up in the air. We don't have concrete text, and it has gone now to the political level. One of the trends is actually
the initiative of some countries to come backwards from the decisions made in Dubai 1 year ago, especially on the issue of transitioning away from fossil fuels. Other countries like the Latin American countries under the negotiating group of ILAC are pushing back so that we don't go backwards in that aim of transitioning away from fossil fuels. Otherwise, we are not moving forward. And this is a financial COP. This means that the goal for finance for the next 10 years on the climate convention will be established. But there is a very polarized and difficult environment for negotiation.
So talk about Colombia's stance. I mean, even the fact that it's the first oil country to join the fossil-free treaty.
Yes, we have run scenarios for Colombia in this transition for the future. In 15 years, our coal markets, and we have to remember everybody, we are the fifth largest exporter of coal in the world, and our economy depends on the export of fossil fuels. So for us, the transition is not only an energy transition, it's a whole economy transition. How are we going to replace the fiscal incomes that are happening from the export of fossil fuels, and also what are the other sectors of the economy that will be replacing them? So for us, it's an environmental stand, but it's also a very pragmatic stand, because what we foresee in the future, 15 years from now, is that our markets will be closing and we need an alternative. But we need a planned transition. And right now, the financial system and the current economic situation is not helping Colombia in that aim. And that's why we have put this process forward. And the fossil fuel treaty is about a call from 14 countries. We hope to be 25 countries in the near future, so that we have rules of the game that create conditions for that transition, and not that we play by the current rules, which are actually very unequal and will punish the transition that Colombia wants to make. And that's why actually the reality is we are expanding fossil fuels in the world. We are making tripling renewables, but at the same time we're expanding fossil fuels. So we are not tackling really the climate problem, and we are creating more energy capacity. We are not using renewables to replace fossil fuels. And this is a big problem. And the reason is we haven't created economic conditions for that economic transition.
So here at the UN Climate Summit, it might surprise many to know that the largest delegation is not Colombia's or the United States or any other country. The largest grouping of people here are the oil and gas lobbyists. So how can this be a successful summit? And what kind of pressure are you under?
That's true. Like the legitimacy of the COP process had been affected in the last 3-4 COPs by two factors. One, the summit is every time closing and closing more to democratic participation. Actually, what we showed in COP16 of biodiversity in Cali is that you can have a people's COP. You can have a COP where people from all walks of life, and especially the ones that are in the front lines of the problem, have a voice, as we were able, for example, to approve the subsidiary body on indigenous peoples. This is not happening in the climate COP. On the contrary, the climate COP is closing, 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 and the corporate interests are more manifest all the time. And I think Brazil, the next COP, which will be again in Latin America, has a very strong mandate to open democratically the COP process again, so we regain legitimacy. And we actually, it's not that the fossil fuel industry cannot be here, because it is one of the key actors, but it cannot dominate and cannot be the one that has privileged access to the summit. And this is happening right now. And of course, part of the discussion here is that some of the fossil fuel producers, especially in the Arab world, are really pushing so that we go one step back from what we achieved in Dubai. That was the acceptance of the COP process in climate, that we needed to transition away from fossil fuels.
Let me ask you about Colombia's record when it comes to being the deadliest country for environmentalists and land defenders. Last year, a record 79 were killed, according to the UK advocacy group Global Witness. How has this impacted Colombia's transition to peace after nearly half a century of war, and impacted progress around the climate?
Actually, it is very correlated. The increase of murders of environment defendants is actually happening exactly in the departments where, or the territories where we are working to consolidate the peace process, and we are dealing with dissidents of FARC and illicit economies. So it's the presence of those factors and the process of stabilization after the peace agreement that is increasing the murders. We have talked extensively to Global Witness about the list. We actually accept the result, and we are working hard by signing the Escazú Agreement, which is a Latin American agreement to defend environmental defenders and to put in a policy of human rights that defends them. But we are also facing this challenge of the transition from the peace process and illicit economies. And it's one of the most critical aspects, because we really believe that is communities on the ground in the field that can make a difference on the climate transition. And if their leadership is inhibited and murdered by these illicit economies, by this struggle that we're having in the territory, of course we cannot advance in our climate goals as we should.
The theme of this summit is finance. Colombia's $40 billion climate investment plan is described as a test case for transition finance. What key lessons do you hope the international community takes from Colombia's approach, your country's approach? You are the head of the delegation here.
Yes, we are putting forward something that we call no excuse plan, because many people say countries don't have the capacity, developing countries, cannot access finance. We have the capacity to put this plan. We have a plan and a strategic vision of how to empower other economic sectors to replace oil and gas. We are doing the hard work of internal consultations with all the sectors. We are putting the numbers together. Now we want the international community to step in, because we are very clear. The Colombian government, the Colombian society, a critical mass of it, is ready to put its part, but we cannot do this alone. We cannot be fair in doing this climate action with access to capital at 10%, when developed countries have access to capital to 1%, when we are almost about to lose our investment qualification, risk qualification, and we are a highly indebted country. But we are not standing still and saying, oh, because of these conditions, we cannot do the transition. On the opposite, we're very proactive. We have strategic vision. We know that this climate transition can be also an economic opportunity for the country, but we are putting all this so that international finance step in and create the condition, and we can show that a country that is in this situation can make a fair and just transition and actually can contribute to climate at the same time.
Now, I wanted to ask you, Susana Mohammed, you were born in Bogota, Colombia, Colombian of Palestinian descent. And I wanted to get your response to the activism here at this summit around a global energy embargo against Israel for its war on Gaza. The other day, we were passing a protest, and this is one of the organizers of the protest, Hamza Hamushin, an organizer with the Global Energy Embargo for Palestine, Palestinian-led campaign. He spoke to us Monday at a protest here at COP29 during a protest supporting the embargo.
Colombia was the biggest exporter of coal to Israel, and President Petro decided in the last few months to ban that export. So we need to escalate our campaigning, the pressure on these countries, and on Brazil as well. Brazil is going to host the COP30 next year, but still it exports oil to the genocidal regime. So these things need to stop. These are our demands.
Colombia has proposed a coal embargo against Israel because of what's happening in Palestine right now. Can you talk about this?
Yes, it was a decision from President Petro on the call of Palestinians in the world. We realized that the Colombian coal was fueling 70% of Israel's energy capabilities. So Colombia the President Petro has signed a decree to forbid the exports of Colombian coal to Israel. We also broke democratic diplomatic relationships with Israel. We don't have diplomatic relationships. And we are calling other countries to not supply energy that is used, actually, fossil fuel energy that is used in genocide. Mm.
And where is your family from in Palestine?
It is from a very small village called Abu Shaydem, very close to Ramallah. And my grandfather migrated to Colombia like almost 100 years ago, actually.
Uh-huh. And your thoughts on what Petro has done, and also for the global call here for a total energy embargo against Israel?
Yes, there is a genocide convention. Actually, we know what is the impact of genocide, what is the impact on human rights, of warfare. We have lived it ourselves. So Colombia takes very seriously our commitments on the Convention on Genocide. And that convention calls countries, states that are part of the convention, to not enable the means towards genocide. So an energy embargo means that parties and countries become responsible for not allowing the means to Israel to commit that genocide. And that's why that's the legal framework. There is also an international court justice resolution this year, sentence this year, that is calling what's happening in Israel and Gaza a genocide. So there is a legal framework for states to act, and that's why the Colombian government is calling other states to not allow and provide the means for a genocide that is happening in life. We can all see it, and that is actually tremendous on the most vulnerable people.
Minister Mohammed, you're the head of the delegation here. President Petro didn't come. Why not?
President Petro canceled at last minute because 1 week after COP16 in Colombia, we had very, very strong rainfall and flooding with one of our states or departamentos, 85% flooded in the most vulnerable area in the country. So he had to attend that situation, and it's a paradox because basically it is because of climate change that we are having these effects that affect the most vulnerable people.
And finally, next year, the COP30 will be in Brazil. I've got two questions. One is, you were head of COP16, the Biodiversity Convention in Cali. How that's different from this COP, what was being achieved? And then here, the COP is coming for the first time right to the Amazon, and what that means as a sister country in Latin America.
Yes, we have worked with the Brazilian government. We call it the route from Cali to Belém, because actually it's 2 years of these COPs in Latin America. It's an extraordinary opportunity for a region to show a different path that puts humanity and nature at the center. Cali was an exemplary COP because we call it a people's COP, and it actually showed how diversity, how the voices of those that are in the front lines of the problem can influence the environment of negotiation, can create empowerment and participation from the diversity of voices. And to solve these issues, climate, biodiversity, which is the loss of nature, which are actually interconnected, we need the knowledge of everybody, and we need the experience, the whole human experience. We cannot undervalue anybody. And also, COP16 in Cali achieved something that so far has not been achieved here. We have created a new source of funding for biodiversity, which is the Cali Fund, and it's a fund that we collect money from the private sector that is using genetic resources when they are in digital databases. They have to contribute now to this multilateral fund that then will be redistributed to the countries that have the biodiversity to protect it. So actually, the Cali COP was very successful in creating this new funding source for global biodiversity to make the private sector paid for the use of those resources, and to convert private money into public money that can actually now protect a common good.
What exactly does biodiversity mean, and why does it matter?
Actually, biodiversity is the diversity of life, and it is all the species that interlinked into what we call the web of life make our planet a living planet, create the ecosystem that provides all the sources of life for everybody to live, including humans. We forget that we are part of the biosphere. We are just not aliens that arrive here and are separated. And that's why when every species that is extincted breaks that chain of life and creates an impact. And some scientists said, because that of human intervention, we are now entering the sixth global extinction of species. It has happened 5 times before in the history of the planet, and we could be entering the sixth, but this time because of the influence of one species with the human beings. So biodiversity COP is about the convention on how to protect the diversity of life on Earth and how to protect nature.
That's Susana Muhammad, Colombia's environment minister, who chairs Colombia's climate delegation here at COP29 in Baku. Coming up, we question Azerbaijan's deputy foreign minister, the COP29 lead negotiator, about Azerbaijan's crackdown on civil society. Stay with us.
The feeling of machines is not pleasure. Not the weather, not the baby, not sex, not feather on spine, not organs or the mind, not feather on spine, not organs.
Machines. By Reverend Billy and the Church of Stop Shopping Choir. Next month, we'll be debuting Extinction, the musical, at Joe's Pub in New York City. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. Earlier today, Democracy Now! Attended the news conference of the COP presidency. It was led by Azerbaijan's deputy foreign minister, Yalcin Rafiev, who's also the COP29 lead negotiator. I asked him a question.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! News. Thank you so much for making the COP presidency available to the press. Many journalists and climate activists have been arrested here in Azerbaijan in the lead up to the COP, including the anti-corruption economist, Gubad Ibadoglu, who's called for greater transparency in oil and gas revenues, and climate activists like Anar Mamadli, who co-founded a climate justice group weeks before the COP. My question is, will they, among many other arrests in this lead up to the COP, be freed? Why were they arrested? And since it's tourism day here at the COP, don't you think that this is a great threat to tourism? When you have a crackdown like this in a country?
Thank you. Surely I'm not going to comment on any ongoing judicial processes. We are here all to make a collective effort for the sake of humanity to agree and adopt important decisions on climate action. And I'm sure with the determination of the parties, we will get there. I would be more than happy to answer any questions related to climate and the ongoing negotiations. Thank you.
They are climate activists, climate economists.
We continue.
After the news conference, I caught up with Yalcin Rafiev of Azerbaijan, representing the COP presidency, as he spoke with journalists outside the room. Sir, could you comment on the climate activists who've been arrested?
He's got quite a busy schedule.
Yes, I understand. As Azerbaijan's chief negotiator moved quickly down the hall, I followed up. Could I just get one quick comment from you on the arrests of the climate activists and the journalists in the lead up to this COP?
I have clearly answered your question. Thank you. I'm sorry that I'm running out towards the meeting.
You said it's not related to climate, but they're climate activists and economists and looking at the gas and oil sector. Just a brief answer from the press.
What?
That was Azerbaijan's chief negotiator representing the COP presidency here at COP29. As I tried to catch up with him after to follow up on my question on the crackdown on the press and climate justice activists in this lead up to the COP, he had said that my question was irrelevant at the news conference, and now he said he was too busy to answer it, although he did stop to answer other journalists' questions. That was Azerbaijan's deputy foreign minister, Yalcin Rafiev, who's also the COP29 lead negotiator. As we broadcast from the UN Climate Summit here in Baku, Azerbaijan, we continue to look at the brutal crackdown on human rights activists, government critics, and the press. In the months ahead of hosting COP29, the Azerbaijani government arrested a number of independent journalists, including three women journalists with the outlet Absas Media, who said they were assaulted earlier this month at a Baku jail while awaiting trial. Since November of last year, at least six journalists with Absas have been arrested. For more, we're going to Berlin, where we're joined by Leyla Mustafayeva, acting editor-in-chief of Absas Media. The online news site has been working out of Berlin due to the crackdown here in Azerbaijan. Leyla, thank you for joining us. You can see that the deputy foreign minister was not willing to talk about the crackdown here, but talk about first what have happened to the women journalists, well, all six journalists of Absas in this lead-up to the COP.
Thank you for having me in the program. So actually, the total crackdown on Azerbaijani media started recently, last year in November. Our news organization, Absas Media, was targeted massively, and six of our journalists, including director Ulvi Hasanli, Sevinç Vakifkızı, editor-in-chief, and two brave journalists, Nargiz Absalamova and Elnare Gasimova, also the project manager, Mehmet Kegalov, and including the investigative journalists, Hafiz Babali was detained on fabricated charts. These journalists are accused in smuggling foreign currency into the country. And they are facing right now from 8 to 12 years imprisonment because in late August this year, the investigator has aggravated the case and added seven more criminal charges against the journalists. And they are still in jail since once here, just detained 1 year ahead of COP, and facing harassment and death threat in jail as well. Just a few months ago, our director, Ulvi Hasanli, was threatened with death just for making the torture cases public from the prison where he is kept. And also our three brave female journalists, Sevinç Vagifkızı, Nargiz Absalamova, and also Elnara Gasimova, has faced violence just a few days ahead COP in a prison which is just kilometers away from the COP venue.
I'm asking you, Leyla, about the decision to host the COP29 here. Absas also conducted investigations looking at who in the Azerbaijani government has benefited from hosting the COP here in Baku.
Yes, they did. Actually, our journalists have been detained for this corruption investigations that they were doing on those here. It was the only media outlet carrying out systematic corruption investigations in the country. But for now, it was not just in vain to jail these journalists at COP because they were going to ask critical questions. Those state officials who is attending in COP29 conference in Baku, including Yalcin Rafiev, deputy foreign minister, who is lead negotiator of COP29 from Azerbaijan. In one of our investigations, we found out that Yalcin Rafiev's brother has lucratively won the tenders in related to reconstruction in Karabakh, despite the fact that the company had violated the environmental regulations. But it could be just one of the questions that our journalists could ask if they would be in freedom and could attend in COP29 conference as well. But in general, this is an event that Azerbaijan authorities are greenwashing their image, because this is a conference, this is a country which the export of the country heavily relies on fossil fuels, namely gas and oil. And additionally, it was a good opportunity for Azerbaijan authorities just to have a lot of fossil fuel lobbyists in order to have a lot of contracts for gas and oil exportation.
We only have a few minutes, and I want to quickly ask you about the women at your news organization. Three of them have said that they were brutalized in pre-trial detention in a Baku jail. Can you explain what happened, who they were?
Just a few days ago, they were oppressed by the prison guardians, due to this instruction coming from the prison governor. They just wanted to have a fresh air in the cells where they are kept. They just stretched their hands out of the prison, small prison door window, in order to make sure that the door is not closed, and all the women who have health problems in jail with them to have fresh air. So, you know, the kind of topics related to air pollution or environmental issues are discussed in COP29 conference. But our journalists, they can't just merely receive a fresh air in the prison.
Leila, in my last question to you, in June of 2023, Abses journalists were arrested for investigating the Gedabek gold mine in western Azerbaijan. A consortium of reporters led by Forbidden Stories later continued their investigation, which found that gold from Azerbaijan is brought to Europe and sold to tech giants like Apple, Tesla, and Microsoft. This is a clip.
June 2023, protests in Azerbaijan were violently crushed. Journalists capturing and publishing footage of these events were arrested, imprisoned, and even threatened with rape. A few months later, Abses media journalists who had covered these demonstrations were arrested again. To this day, they are still detained. In the meantime, Forbidden Stories took over their investigations to tell the stories they could no longer pursue. This investigation has led us to some of the biggest names in tech and banking.
We're talking about Microsoft, Tesla, and other giants of the tech or the industry. I'm not sure they are aware about what's going on in the mine where they are buying the gold through the raffinery.
Another person mentioned in this Forbidden Stories documentary is John Sununu, the former governor of New Hampshire, the father of the current governor, Chris Sununu. John Sununu also served as President George H.W. Bush's chief of staff. He's one of the shareholders in Anglo-Asian Mining, AAM, a gold mining company in Azerbaijan. What did Abses Media discover about the work of this mining company in this last 60 seconds we have?
One of our journalists, Nagizab Salamova, was covering the protests which broke out related to the gold mining and construction of Cyanide Lake in this village, which is actually put under police control currently. The Abses Media covered this protest and was going also to hold an independent water and soil test in order to see whether this complaint of coming from the residents or not. But they were jailed, unfortunately, and they couldn't just carry out independent tests in order to find out whether the soil and air was polluted with cyanide or not. They are just jailed, and it was one of the purposes just to silence the journalists, to prevent them from doing further investigation related to this gold mine in western province in Azerbaijan.
Leila Mustafavaya, thank you so much for being with us. Acting Editor-in-Chief of the award-winning Azerbaijani independent media outlet Absas Media, the online news site, has been working from outside Azerbaijan since six of their journalists were arrested and imprisoned in the lead-up to this climate summit. Leila was speaking to us from Berlin, Germany. Coming up, Donald Trump has picked the former head of World Wrestling Entertainment to be Secretary of Education, and Dr. Mehmet Oz to run the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. He is a backer of privatizing Medicare. Back in 20 seconds. Covered by Grace Jones. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We end today's show looking at President-elect Trump's latest nominees. Trump has nominated billionaire Linda McMahon to head the Department of Education, which Trump has pledged to shut down. McMahon is the former CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment. She headed the Small Business Administration during Trump's first term. She gave at least $15 million to a pro-Trump PAC during this election. She and her husband, Vince McMahon, were recently sued for failing to stop a WWE ringside announcer from sexually assaulting young boys. Vince McMahon also has been sued by a former WWE employee who accused him of sexual assault and of trafficking her to other men. We're joined now by the education historian, Diane Ravitch, who served as Assistant Secretary of Education under President George H.W. Bush. Diane Ravitch, thanks so much for joining us. In these few minutes we have with you, talk about this latest nomination by President-elect Trump. Talk about McMahon.
Well, I had to learn about her because she is not someone who's been engaged in the field of education at all. She led the Small Business Administration in the previous Trump term. President-elect Trump has a habit of choosing people who have either a desire to destroy the department or who have no experience. She falls into the latter category. She does not have any experience in education. Although she was spent 1 year on the Connecticut State Board of Education, but otherwise she's a businesswoman. She would have been well qualified to head the Commerce Department, and apparently that's the job she wanted. But her job now, according to Project 2025 and everything that Trump has said, is to eliminate the Department of Education. She is not qualified to run the department because she doesn't know anything about it. And it's hard to say whether or not Congress will go along with the president's desire. He cannot single-handedly abolish the Department of Education. This is something that has to be done, if at all, by Congress.
Well, let me ask you something. She gave more than $7 million to two pro-Trump super PACs in 2016. As well, this year, gave $10 million to the Make America Great Again PAC. President Trump says, we will send education back to the states and Linda will spearhead that effort. What would it mean if the Department of Education were shut down?
Well, what Project 2025 says is that they're going to block grant all the federal funding. What that means is that they will take whatever money is currently going to the states, send it to the states with no strings. So right now, when a state gets money for Title I, it goes to schools that have a lot of poor children. When they get money for children with disabilities, it goes to schools that have children with disabilities. With the block granting, which is what they have in mind, There would be no strings attached. They could divert that money for other purposes. So Project 2025 says that at some point the federal funding was simply stopped. And they're really saying to the states, we're going to take away your federal funding. Here it is. You can have it now. But eventually it will dry up and you'll have to take care of your own federal monies, or not federal monies, make it up from state monies. What that means is basically going back to 1965, where there were vast inequities among the states, which was the reason for passing federal aid to education. It was an equity measure, and that equity measure will be wiped out.
A final question. This from the New York Times. She's played an influential role in laying the groundwork for a second Trump presidency as the chair of America First Policy Institute, which has set out a more immediate list of changes it says could be achieved through vastly changing the department's priorities. Those include stopping schools from promoting inaccurate and unpatriotic concepts, quote unquote, about American history surrounding institutionalized racism, and expanding voucher programs. She's always talked about being pro-choice, not in terms of abortion, but in terms of privatizing schools.
That's unfortunately continuing a trend that started long ago under, I guess, Reagan, although Reagan was not able to do anything to make it happen. But choice got embedded into No Child Left Behind with the charter school movement, and then the charter school movement turned into the voucher movement, and they're now about half of the states, almost all of them red states, do have voucher programs, and these voucher programs enroll children who are predominantly well-to-do. They're not helping kids who are poor. Most of the kids who take vouchers never attended a public school. So the voucher program is a subsidy for kids who are already in private and religious schools, and it's been a tremendous boon for religious schools. And when you add that to the Supreme Court having... Steinbrook, director of Public Citizens Health Research Group. In these 2 minutes we have left, Dr. Steinbrook, talk about the significance of Oz, if he's approved, to head CMS.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a strange choice. Dr. Oz is a physician, which is good, but his background really has nothing to do with the Center for Medicare's and Medicaid services. It touches half the country in terms of providing medical care. It's a complex bureaucratic organization, which also has regulatory structures. Dr. Oz is a celebrity physician. He's promoted various treatments and supplements of a dubious value, but that's really not what CMS is about. It's not the FDA. And it remains to be seen how he could be effective in this position if he's confirmed. The one thing I'll mention is that Dr. Oz, specific to CMS, is he's a supporter of Medicare Advantage and increasing privatization of Medicare. Medicare Advantage already covers about 54% of people under Medicare, and we think that's the wrong way to go. We'd like to see traditional Medicare strengthened so that there would be a level playing field. Medicare Advantage often overcharges the federal government, and it's strengthening it, making it even more lucrative for private insurers, is not the way to go.
Dr. Robert Steinbrook, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Public Citizen Health Research Group Director. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with a remarkable team. Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Hannah Elias, and Dennis Moynihan. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Maddie Eliana Ozbeck, Emily Anderson. To continue to watch our coverage of COP29 here in Baku, Azerbaijan, we'll be here for the whole week. Go to democracynow.org. Tomorrow is Women's Day here at the UN Summit, and we'll be bringing you women from around the world. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, we're All Black Era.
And you're listening to
CFRC Radio in Kingston, Canada.
For her upcoming three albums, A Living Dream draws inspiration from a mantra that Savannah's grandmother has held throughout her life. I have a dream life. Initially interpreted as a reflection on a beautiful life, this phrase transformed after her passing into a powerful mantra of manifestation for Savannah. Now, I have a dream life serves as both a reminder of gratitude for what's being created and a source of encouragement.